I know what you did last summer. If you were a teen in the 90s, those seven words mean more to you than reminiscing about summer vacation. It probably takes you back to 1997, sitting in a dark movie theater, the smell of buttered popcorn, dirty carpets, and Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit subtly playing in the background while the previews roll before the movie begins. The movie title with those same seven words, I Know What You Did Last Summer, a horror film. Classic. Iconic. The movie was based on a teen fiction novel written by Lois Duncan. When Lois first saw the movie adaptation of her book, she said she was utterly horrified. This response could be looked at as surprising since most of her novels include the same themes of violence. The thing that caught her off guard was that the movie was a slasher movie. She said, and I quote, "The first time I knew it was a slasher movie was when I bought my popcorn and bought my ticket, excitedly walked into the theater, the heads were dropping, and the blood was squirting, and I was screaming, and the audience was screaming." As tragic as her storylines were in her novels, nothing was more terrifying than a real-life tragedy that struck her family in the summer of 1989. That's the story that I'm going to be telling you in this video. Lois Duncan was born on April 28, 1934, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her parents were Joseph and Lois Steinmetz. They were internationally renowned magazine photographers who were pretty well known for taking photos of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Lois grew up in Pennsylvania before moving to Sarasota, Florida in her early teens. Her parents continued their work as circus photographers, and Lois spent a lot of her time surrounded by circus performers, which was very inspiring for her. Lois dreamed of being a writer since she was just a child. Many even say that she was brilliant. At the age of 10, she submitted her first story to a publication, and at the age of 13, she sold her first article to a magazine called Calling All Girls. Throughout her high school years, she had been a regular contributor to teen magazines, including Seventeen. Lois had a sense of humor. She wasn't afraid to make fun of herself and make light of more serious situations. She would commonly refer to herself as a shy bookworm and a dreamer. She enjoyed playing outside in the woods as much as she loved immersing herself in her reading and writing. Two of her favorite books were The Wizard of Oz and Mary Poppins. With photographers as parents, Lois had the opportunity to be the subject of beautiful pictures taken of her in places like this barrier island called Siesta Key in Florida. Not only that, this photo was on the cover of Collier's magazine in the July 9th, 1949 edition. Lois graduated from Sarasota High School in 1952 and was accepted to Duke University. And that's where she met her first husband, fellow student Joseph Cardozo. Lois wanted to start a family, so she dropped out of Duke in 1953. Even though she wasn't in college, it didn't stop her from working very hard. She wrote over 300 articles that were published in magazines. Lois and her first husband had three children, two daughters, Robin and Carrie, as well as a son named Brett. After 10 years of marriage, Lois and Joseph got a divorce and she moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is where she taught for the journalism department at the University of New Mexico while she continued to write for magazines and support her family by writing greeting cards. Despite not having a degree, she was able to land the job at the University of New Mexico because one of her friends was the chair of the journalism department. Lois was hired as a replacement based on her experience writing for magazines. She went on to author 48 books, from picture books for children to adult novels, but she's most recognized for her young adult thriller novels. Lois has been dubbed the queen of teen thrillers by many critics and journalists, and as the pioneering figure of young adult fiction. It's pretty awesome, and she's so talented. Numerous titles have been named Best Books for Young Adults by the American Library Association and Junior Literary Guild. Her books have received Young Readers Awards in 16 states and 3 other countries. Lois earned the Margaret A. Edwards Award, which is sponsored by the School Library Journal and the Young Adult Library Services Association in 1992. This award recognizes a living author who has produced an outstanding corpus of teenage writing. She explained, "I started writing for young adults because I was one." And you know what? She was good at it. She could really bring the characters and the story to life. Her stories resonated with teens because they were full of angst and challenges with fitting in, and of course, the mystery and suspense of the characters being put into these rather chilling situations. In 1965, Lois married an electrical engineer. His name is Donald Arquette. They went on to have two children of their own, Donald Jr. and Caitlin. Lois and her children from her previous marriage took Donald's last name. This story revolves around Lois's youngest child, Kate Arquette. I'd like to briefly mention her other children because each one of them are highly gifted. Robin Arquette Birkin is a singer and composer, and she collaborated with Lois on a series of musical CDs for children called Songs of Childhood. Carrie Arquette writes children books. She's also the co-owner and editor-in-chief of Cantata Publishing Company. Brett Arquette is the author of three adult novels, two of them are horror books, and Donnie Arquette is an extremely talented artist. Now let's jump in to when and where this story unfolds. It was 1989. Three of the Arquette children, Brett, Don Jr., and Kate, were still living in Albuquerque. Carrie and Robin were living in Dallas and Florida. I want to introduce you to Caitlin, or as she was affectionately known, Kate. Caitlin Claire Arquette was born on September 18th, 1970. Lois said that when Kate was born, she had an odd little hollow on the ridge of her left cheekbone, and upon seeing it, Lois was worried. She said, "My baby has a hole in her face," but the doctors let her know she didn't have anything to worry about and that it wouldn't be permanent. Lois says that it was permanent. However, Kate's family would refer to it as a misplaced dimple, and they would joke around all the time calling it God's fingerprint. Growing up the youngest of Lois's five children, Kate was said to have trailed a little bit behind her brothers, but she was absolutely adored by her parents. Lois referred to her as her mini daredevil because when she was a child, they were at a motel swimming pool, and Caitlin just decided to jerk her hand right out of Lois's and jump right into the deep end of the pool. Caitlin was described as funny, nice, absolutely clean-cut and well-dressed. And when she was in high school, she was outgoing and popular and extremely ambitious. She had dreams of becoming a doctor one day. Caitlin was very studious. She was in the National Honor Society, and she took college courses in her senior year and continued to take those courses during summer after graduation. Kate had graduated with honors from Highland High School on June 14th, 1989. By the time she graduated, Kate was dating her boyfriend, Dong Nguyen, for about a year and a half. Nguyen was a Vietnamese immigrant who had lived in California before moving to Albuquerque with one of his friends. The two met at a coffee house, according to Kate. Nguyen hadn't exactly had the perfect childhood. Kate describes his childhood as horrific because of his journey to America and how hard that was. Nguyen was 8 years older than Kate, but she lied to her family and told them he was only 4 years older than her. She knew they would not approve of her dating someone so much older. Kate and Nguyen had been living together for 6 weeks in an apartment that Kate rented right before she graduated because she got a settlement payment from an insurance company after the car accident in California. Lois liked Nguyen. He spent a lot of time at their home with Kate, and he seemed really nice and it appeared as though they got along really well. Kate was currently employed as a supervisor of a clothing department at Pier 1 Imports. She was awaiting the fall semester at the University of New Mexico while she was taking those summer classes. It was July. She was just starting to enjoy her summer vacation. However, things weren't going so well with Nguyen. Despite what it looked like from the outside, there were issues between the couple that they just could not resolve. On Sunday, July 16th, Kate stopped by her parents' home on her way to visit a friend, Sharon. Lois noticed that Kate's eyes appeared to be red and puffy, and when she asked Kate about it, Kate explained that she was mad at Nguyen. Kate always cried whenever she was mad, and Lois knew this. She told her mother that they had gotten into a fight the night before and things had started to go downhill ever since they moved in together. She had finally had enough, and she was going to break up with him. Kate's dad suggested that she move back home, but Kate refused. She said she loved her new apartment, and she was just sorry that she ever let Nguyen move in with her. She regretted that decision so much. Kate's parents tried to offer a few suggestions about how she could handle the situation. I keep thinking to myself, this girl is so young. She's 18 years old, dealing with a man that's close to 30. Lois told Kate that she could ask Nguyen to move out. Kate said she had, but he had told her that it was his place too, and that in Vietnam, women do whatever men tell them. However, Kate's name was the only one on the lease, and the utilities were in her name as well. Kate's parents were worried, and Lois asked Kate who this Sharon girl was, because they had never met her nor even heard about her before. Kate explained that they met while she was at work because Sharon sold shaved Hawaiian ice outside of Pier 1 Imports. When Lois asked her what she had planned for that night, she said she was either going to stay at Sharon's or she would come back to their house to sleep. She also insisted to her parents that they do not let Nguyen know where she was if he called. Lois kind of felt weird about this. She felt it was cruel not to tell him. She was worried that he might assume Kate got into a car accident or something if she never came home. But she promised Kate that she wouldn't tell Nguyen as long as Kate left Sharon's phone number so that they could get a hold of her in case they needed to. When you find out what happens next, this becomes very eerie. Kate left her parents' home around 6:15 p.m. She wanted to give herself plenty of time to get to Sharon's house because she had never been there before. Plus, she wanted to grab some ice cream to bring over. As she was leaving, she yelled to her parents, "Later! I'll see you later, guys!" Sharon had given Kate written directions to show the route to take to her house in Old Town. It seemed like a fairly normal night until Lois and Don were woken up by a phone call a little before midnight. It's the type of call that no parent ever wants to receive. It was from the emergency room at the University of New Mexico Hospital. It was about Kate. There must have been so much fear inside these poor parents. They wanted to know everything. All they were told was that Kate had been rushed to the ER after being injured. Nothing else was explained to them until they arrived at the hospital. As she and Don rushed over, her mind was in overdrive, thinking about what could have possibly happened to Kate and how serious it could be. Lois's biggest fear at the time was that Kate had a bad head injury because 2 years prior, Kate's cousin had been in a car accident and it left him brain damaged. Kate was so deeply upset about what happened to her cousin, and Lois just didn't want that for Kate. Let's go back to what was known at this point. By 11 p.m., Kate's car was found off the side of the road. She had apparently been in a car accident, and it looked as though she had hit something, possibly another vehicle. She must have lost control of the car. It veered over the median and slammed into a telephone pole at the intersection of Lomas and Arno Streets. The accident hadn't even been called into 911 yet. It had just happened, and an off-duty officer, Ronald Merriman, happened to be passing through that area right after the crash. He spotted two cars parked on a sidewalk, Kate's red Ford Tempo and a second vehicle, a gray Volkswagen Beetle. So he stops to see if anyone was injured. As Merriman drove past the cars, that's when he reported the accident. And at the time, he didn't believe there were any injuries because he spotted a man standing next to Kate's car. The officer was wrong. It wasn't until he and the young man walked up to Kate's car to investigate that they discovered her, seemingly unconscious, drenched in blood, and sprawled across both front seats of her vehicle. They did not move her, but as they looked around to try to piece everything together and figure out what happened, they could hear her quietly moaning and crying. After the accident is reported, the first officer that was dispatched to the scene was Officer Mary Ann Wallace, and she arrived within 40 seconds of getting that call. Wow, that's fast. And when she arrived, she reported seeing only Kate's vehicle on the sidewalk and seeing Detective Merriman speaking with the man, which was the man who was standing next to Kate's car when Merriman arrived. Merriman relayed to Wallace that the driver of the Ford had been in an accident, and he informed her that he had already called for an ambulance. When Wallace began examining Kate's car, mind you, she's still unconscious in the front seat at this time, and that was only because a short amount of time had passed. It wasn't long before Wallace was looking over everything, trying to piece it together, when something stood out to her. It was the way that the driver's side window was shattered. I have a picture of the actual window right here. Not only does it take an immense amount of force to shatter a window, the way that the car was sitting, it didn't look like it was consistent with the damage to the car. Upon closer inspection, Wallace began to feel differently about this being an accident at all. It looked as though the window had been shot out with a firearm. Her gut feeling and her experience told her that this was a crime scene. So she radioed back to the police station for backup. Flashing forward to Kate being admitted to the hospital. When Lois arrived, a nurse informed her that Kate was alive, but in critical condition. The nurse said that the family needed to prepare themselves for the fact that they might lose her. Lois assumed that Kate had gotten into a bad car accident, but she was shocked to learn what really happened to Kate. I don't want to, but I have to censor words, as per usual, on YouTube. So we all know what happens when you use a firearm. We know what it does. And one was used on her. Not only did Kate's car veer off the road and hit a pole, she had been struck 2 times before or following the crash. Both wounds are shown on this picture here. It's just a graphic. One is in the left cheekbone and one above it is in close proximity to her left temple. This suggested the shooter came up to the driver's side window and shot right through it. But why? With everything that was going on, machines, doctors, tubing, the shock that she must have been feeling at that moment, Lois questioned the nurse about whether they were sure this was Kate. I'm sure many parents would be wishing it wasn't, that it must be some kind of mistake. The medical staff informed Lois that there was a photo ID in her wallet. They knew it was Kate. They had been able to look at her before she arrived at the hospital, before the injuries became more severe, before anything had been done to her, before she was in such critical condition. She was placed on life support, and the hardest part up until this point was when the doctor informed Lois and Dawn that although it was possible, it wasn't probable that Kate would ever regain consciousness. It was absolutely devastating. How can this happen? Kate was just at their house hours earlier. She was walking, she was talking, she was alive, and now she was very much on the brink of death. Lois and Dawn immediately called their other children to inform them that they needed to hurry and get to the hospital. While Carrie and Dawn Jr. and Brett were able to make it, at least relatively quickly, Robin, who was in Florida, told Lois she wouldn't be able to get a flight until the next day. Back at the crime scene, Merriman got the name and phone number of the witness that was next to Kate's car when he arrived. The man explained that he had been driving by when he spotted Kate's car. He stopped to make sure she was okay, and before he even had a chance to call 911, Merriman showed up. More officers arrived, they examined the scene, and allegedly left before medics even arrived, although they dispute this. After speaking to the young man with the Volkswagen, Merriman was satisfied with the information that was provided, so he didn't question him any further. The detective was trying to focus on staying with Kate until the paramedics arrived. Officer Wallace was directing traffic during this time. However, something seemed a bit odd about this situation. When the paramedics arrived, they stated in individual affidavits that there were no officers, no police cars, nobody was there. They said they almost missed the scene because they didn't see any police officers or any cars and no one was waving them over. And that's crazy to me. There's a young woman unconscious in a vehicle. And if this was true, that means she was left unattended until paramedics came. We'll dig a little deeper into this later on. Police found the written directions to Sharon's house lying on the floorboard of the driver's side of the car. It's right here in this picture. They used this information to lead them to Sharon Smith's house. This was the only lead that they had at the time. When they interviewed Sharon, she told Albuquerque Police Department that Kate arrived at her home around 9:30 p.m. The two ate dinner together. Then they went over to a friend's house to do some interior decorating. Sharon described Kate's evening. She said that Kate seemed very upset. She kept bursting into tears for no apparent reason. She even made Sharon call her apartment over and over again to see if Nguyen was there. Kate didn't want to speak to him. She just wanted to know where he was. There was never an answer from Nguyen. Sharon called the apartment for the final time at 10:40 p.m. and there was still no answer. As the night came to a close, Kate told Sharon she was going to head back to her parents' house. Even though Sharon invited her to stay, Kate said she couldn't because she had summer classes and she needed to study. Sharon said she wasn't an intuitive person, but that night she had a bad feeling about Kate leaving. Around 10:45 p.m., Kate left Sharon's in her red Ford Tempo and headed east along Lomas Road back in the direction of her parents' home. However, after hearing about Kate's argument with her boyfriend, Nguyen, the police decide to make their way over to the apartment to interview him. Around 5 in the morning, detectives arrived at Kate's apartment. They knocked, Nguyen came to the door, and it looked as though he had been sleeping. He wasn't aware of anything that happened to Kate, and he was shocked to learn the news from the detectives. But first, they asked him what he had been doing that night. He said he went out, he was playing pool, having some drinks with friends. He said that his friends dropped him back at the apartment around 10 p.m. As detectives were looking around, they found a note that was on top of a kitchen table. Nguyen said that he found that note when he returned home and it said, "Hun, where are you? I know you're still mad. I'm so sorry, okay? I miss you today. I went to my mom's house to return these books. I'll see you, love." Nguyen told officers that he believed that note had been from Kate. I'm sitting here thinking, you believed it was from Kate? Who else would it be from when you live with your girlfriend, Kate? It's a little bit odd. Nguyen told police that he waited and waited for Kate to return, but she never came home. He also said that no one called him. Nobody informed him of anything. The police just showed up at his apartment, began questioning him, proceeded to search the entire apartment, go through everything. They asked him, "Do you own a gun?" And he's just standing there confused. No one was telling him why. They didn't explain why they were there. He kept asking them, "What happened? What happened?" Detectives even conducted a gunshot residue test on Nguyen's hands before they left the apartment. That ended up coming back negative. Before they left, police finally told Nguyen what happened. At that moment, he rushed to the scene. But Kate had already been taken to the hospital, so then he rushed there to join her family. Lois claims that when Nguyen arrived at the hospital, she heard him whisper under his breath, "It's all my fault." Nguyen began to think about all the things he enjoyed doing with Kate. They loved singing together, playing music together, riding around in the car. They had just gotten a cat on Saturday, and they hadn't even gotten a chance to name it. They tried, but they couldn't decide on one because neither one liked the name that the other one came up with. It's sad. You never know what's going to happen to someone. And Kate ended up coding at one point before Robin had a chance to get there. The doctors were eventually able to stabilize her. Some of the members, including Lois and Dawn, had to go home. They had to just rest for a little while after such a long night, but their phone kept ringing. They were afraid to ignore any of the calls in case it was the hospital. They ended up saying, "Forget it, we're just going to return to Kate's bedside." When they arrived back at the hospital, Carrie told them that when Kate had coded earlier, she had a hemorrhage that flooded her brainstem, and doctors now believed that she was completely brain dead. The family went in, and they were saying their last goodbyes to Kate. Hours later, Robin was finally able to make it, and she got the chance to say goodbye to Kate. Since she was pronounced dead Monday, July 17th, around 8:15 p.m., her parents decided to have her organs donated. They thought that's what Kate would have wanted. Her heart and her lungs were donated to a man named Paul at Presbyterian Hospital, who received a rare heart and lung transplant. Without Kate's heart and lungs, he would have had zero chance of survival. Her liver was donated to a man in Los Angeles, her kidneys were sent to San Francisco, and her pancreas was sent to Miami for research. This was happening so fast. Lois had just been telling Kate that she was going to be out of her teens in no time, and they were both looking forward to her turning 20. Kate had said that she couldn't believe she would ever be 20, and it turned out to be true. Now she wouldn't even get the chance to see the age of 19. Kate's family wanted answers. By July 20th, just a few days after Kate had passed away, a memorial service was held for her. Family and friends gathered to pay their respects and to tell stories about Kate, and that helped keep her memory alive. One childhood friend, Molly Onan, who had known Kate since they were both kids, remembered the family vacations together. Their families would take them on camping trips in Pecos Mountains. One time, Molly said that she painted Kate's face white to look like a clown and that Kate loved it. She was a genuinely happy person. And it was so tragic to think about what ended up happening to her. But what did happen to her? There weren't a lot of answers. Police told the family that they believed it was just a random shooting. It was most likely Kate in the wrong place at the wrong time. There had been a string of random crimes in that same area involving drivers. And this happened within the same couple months. One was Vincent Ray Chavez. He was shot in the back of the head on June 24th while he was sitting in his car, and that it was potentially gang related. The next one was Marvin Padilla. He was stabbed 3 times in the heart on June 27th following a traffic dispute with another man. Philip Baca ended up turning himself in along with a pair of scissors that he stabbed Padilla with. He claimed it was self-defense. He was arrested and charged with murder. Mark Sanchez was fatally shot on July 4th after an argument and a car chase with another driver. He was shot around 11 p.m. A 44-year-old man would later turn himself in, and after being questioned, he was released, and he wasn't even charged at the time. He claimed that Sanchez threatened him and punched him before he shot him. Another man, Ricky Galeos, was shot in a drive-by shooting at Eddie Garcia Park while him and his uncle were playing basketball. His uncle was shot as well. Police suspected that this shooting could also have been gang-related. Taking all of this into account, although the victims were all men, and every case had someone come forward to confess, they thought that it could possibly be another gang-related crime. But in this case, there were so few leads. No one was coming forward. They didn't have any real witnesses except that one guy who pulled over to help Kate. And if it hadn't been for the shooting, they would have just ruled this an accident on account of maybe Kate falling asleep or a hit and run. But the shooting part threw police off. It really did seem random. But then some new information came in from people that were close to Kate. And this is where things get a little interesting, confusing, and odd. Lois would not believe for a second that this was a random crime. She took it upon herself to investigate this case on her own. A few weeks after Kate's death, when looking at phone records, Lois discovered that there had been 3 phone calls made from Kate's apartment on the night she was pronounced dead. So this was after the accident, while Kate is lying in the hospital fighting for her life. Was it Nguyen? No, because he had been with them at the hospital. So she knew it wasn't him, and she believed there should have been no one else in that apartment. So who made these calls? 2 of them were to 1 number, and the 3rd was to a different number. The 2nd number Lois had recognized. So she went to check her directory to find out if the phone number was in there, and it was written down in her own writing. This was the phone number that Kate had given her mother back in March. It was supposed to be the phone number of Nguyen's sister, the one that lived in California. Kate and Nguyen took a trip to California in March for Kate's spring break. They were there to go to Disneyland, and they were supposed to be staying with the sister. Well, it turns out there was a completely different reason that they made a trip to Southern California, and it was very surprising and troubling. Lois couldn't believe it. How could her 18-year-old daughter be involved in a major criminal organization? But it was true. Could this be why she was potentially targeted? It made a lot of sense, but it needed to be investigated a lot more. They needed more information to figure out how she was even involved in something like this. The calls were made just minutes after Kate was pronounced dead. It's a little bit weird. Nguyen was at the hospital. The apartment should have been empty. I kind of said this already. So what was going on here? Why would somebody be there? Well, apparently Kate admitted everything to her sister, Carrie. She said the truth was that this trip hadn't been everything that it was made out to be. While in California, Nguyen staged a car accident in the car that Kate rented in her own name with Lois's credit card. This was an insurance scheme, and it was orchestrated by a large group of members of the Vietnamese community that Nguyen knew from back when he lived in Southern California. Nguyen rear-ended a car, which turns out to be driven by people that are in on the scheme. All the individuals that were involved in this accident complained of soft tissue injuries, and they were all treated by a doctor. A paralegal out of Southern California handled the insurance claim. And eventually, both Nguyen and Cates were given $1,500 as part of the settlement. It's believed that the doctor and the paralegal were also part of the insurance scam. This is the money that Kate used to rent her apartment in which Nguyen started to live. Wow. Okay, this is intense. She's 18 years old. Obviously, her boyfriend is a bad influence, and Lois went to the police about this and gave them the information. She was speculating that perhaps this was a potential motive behind Kate's death. She knew that Kate had issues with Nguyen, and Kate had mentioned breaking up with him. She questioned whether this Vietnamese group thought that Kate was going to blow the whistle on the illegal operation. Lois believed that they could have had one of their members get rid of Kate or hired someone to do it. Police also informed Lois that Nguyen didn't have a sister in California. These calls made out of Kate's apartment had been to the paralegal in California, presumably the same one involved in the insurance scam, helping stage all of these fake accidents. This was a lot for the family to take in. Sounds like Nguyen was bad news. However, it seems as though Nguyen took Kate's death very hard. He went to Lois one night and told her that he was having trouble sleeping. She gave him 2 sleeping pills, but Nguyen asked her for the whole bottle. Lois ended up refusing to give him any more from that moment on. She was afraid of what he might do. It didn't matter. Nguyen would end up in the hospital regardless. Only 5 days after Kate was shot, Nguyen took a 4-inch knife and turned it on himself, severely puncturing his stomach. Oh my God, this is a mess. Once Nguyen was stable, detectives interviewed him about why he would do this to himself. He told them that he had been distraught, depressed since Kate's death. He felt like everyone was blaming him for it. Does he have a guilty conscience? I don't know. In the event it was true that he got involved with criminals and then this happened, he would be guilty by association. That's going to be a terrible situation, but he's still a person of interest in the actual crime. Lois visited Nguyen while he was in the hospital, and she told him that she didn't think he was responsible for Kate's death, but she believed that he knew who was. She told him he needed to decide whether or not he loved Kate enough to tell the truth. Lois claimed that at this point, Nguyen told her, and I'm quoting, "I know, I'm deciding." Lois called the police after leaving the hospital and she told him this information. Allegedly, a friend of Kate's had also claimed that on the night of Kate's shooting, Nguyen had called her and said, "Kate's dead, they shot her," before the police ever even arrived at his apartment. I don't know about this. Sometimes wires can be crossed, but it is weird, if true. Police brought Nguyen in after he was released from the hospital, and at this point, he denied ever saying anything like that to Lois. He said he had no idea who did this to Kate. He also told them that his car accident in California was not staged for insurance purposes. Something else happened. Shortly after Kate's death, Nguyen called Lois, and he told her he had been locked out of the apartment. Lois called the apartment manager and said, "Listen, I'm fine with Nguyen staying there." However, the apartment manager told her there was no way he was going to let Nguyen stay there. He told her that he didn't think it was a good idea, that Nguyen was bad news. This is when the apartment manager let Lois know he wasn't sure exactly what was going on with Nguyen and Kate, but there had been times Kate had come running over to his door, begging to sleep on his couch, telling him she was scared. Kate even asked him to change the locks at one point, which he did, but after that, windows ended up being smashed in because Nguyen's friends got in the way. The apartment manager also informed Lois that Kate had locked Nguyen out one night and he ended up kicking in the door. Okay, yeah, this guy is not good news. He's bad news. Lois asked investigative reporter Mike Gallagher to look into Kate's relationship with Nguyen. She felt that something wasn't right. There were problems the police were not looking into. They were failing to go deeper. Gallagher met up with the landlord that claimed or believed that Kate was afraid of Nguyen and his friends. And he relayed to Gallagher that Kate and Nguyen argued mostly about a few topics, money and Nguyen wanting to move back to California. Thirdly, the way that Nguyen treated her. The landlord claimed that in one instance, Kate had ran to his apartment, like he had told Lois, and she told him that she was scared that Nguyen was going to hurt her. Gallagher took a look at that note that Kate had supposedly left on the night of the shooting, and he compared it to other samples of her writing. And to him, he said it was obvious that the note was not written by Kate, and that Nguyen had been lying to police right after she had been shot. Months were passing, and there were still no solid answers or leads in this case. Until November, when a tip came in from Crime Stoppers, and this identified four potential suspects in Kate's case. More tips would come in over the following weeks. Police still believe and told the family that Kate was just chased down and shot on the corner of Lomas and John Street. Her car then proceeded to travel 719 feet, cross over two traffic lanes, hop the median, cross three more lanes, go up on the sidewalk, past the intersection, and crash into a light pole. They say the location of the shooting was defined by a large pile of broken glass at Lomas and John. However, there was nothing to document the existence of that glass. It was not gathered up as evidence, nor was it even photographed. I keep thinking, is this another botched investigation by police? The Arquette family and their investigators think that the crime scene may have been altered before investigators got there. The crime scene technicians got to Kate late because they were working at another crime scene where there was a police shooting. Reports state that the technicians were met at the crime scene by a Sergeant John B. Gallegos. When investigators dug deeper, they realized that a lot of these reports that were written were not based on firsthand accounts at the crime scene. They were given to the crime scene technicians from information passed on by Sergeant Gallegos. And this man was reportedly a rogue cop. He was known to party at the Chop Shop on Arno Street. It's one half block north of the crime scene. He had since been fired from Albuquerque Police Department for burglarizing a liquor store. And this was while he was on duty. So could this be more convoluted? Arno Street was right behind the Chop Shop where stolen cars were stored. It also served as a drug distribution center. This was a known hangout for rogue cops, including Gallegos. Several of those cops known to hang out there had since been convicted of felonies. Kate may have been in a position where she learned about some of these activities because some of the cars were stolen by Vietnamese car thieves. The owner of the chop shop said that he knew Kate. I'm just in shock by this. How in the world would a girl like her get involved in any of this? Look how innocent she looks. I mean, I'm not sure any of this is true, but why would all of these people make this up? Well, on January 11th, 1990, 6 months after the shooting, an informant met with police and told them that four men were involved in the crime. One of them was Juve Escobedo, who was driving the car. A man named Miguel Garcia was the one that used the firearm on Kate. Robert Garcia and Dennis Martinez. This informant also told the detective that Robert Garcia may have information about the whole incident. Just a few days later, on January 17th, 1990, Robert Garcia was brought into the police headquarters and interrogated for 2 hours. He admitted that he was out with friends on the night that Kate was shot, and that Kate was shot by Miguel on a dare. After Robert Garcia's interrogation, police end up arresting Dennis Martinez, Miguel Garcia, and Juve Escobedo. According to Robert, it was Miguel who shot the gun, firing what he claimed were three shots at Kate's car. Police also discovered that Juve had recently sold his car, a brown Chevrolet Camaro. This was significant because on the night of the shooting, a truck driver reported seeing a brown Camaro chasing a young woman in a car that was said to be similar to Kate's in the area she would later be found in about an hour later. He told police that he believed there were two or three people in that vehicle. This tip had initially been dismissed, figures, but it seemed to be much more relevant now. Police believed that the men had been out joyriding, and Kate just became a random victim. In November of 1989, when Miguel Garcia and Juve Escobedo were interviewed, they both denied any involvement in the shooting. A tape recorder was secretly placed in their holding cell, and they continued to deny their involvement. Dennis Martinez, however, initially told detectives that he had been in the car when Miguel shot at Kate. He also said that he had been drunk at the time and hadn't seen Miguel shoot anyone, but heard the gunshots. Just when police begin to think that they're making headway in this case, it all starts to unravel at the seams. Police discovered that Robert Garcia, the man that they interrogated, that provided them all that information, the names of all the other men, had been in jail on the night that Kate was shot. When asked about this, Robert said that he actually heard about the shooting from Dennis Martinez and that he was just scared during this interrogation. So he told police what they wanted to hear. And this confuses the hell out of me. This is a real issue during interrogations. Under pressure, people crack and then they admit to things that they didn't even do. When I think about this, all I can think about is, why would you rather go to prison? Like, why are you not scared of prison, but you're scared of the police and you tell them something you didn't do? Miguel Garcia, the man who was suspected as using the firearm, his house was searched and they found several weapons, but all of them were ruled out as being involved in Kate's case. The truck driver's statement was contradictory as well, because the sighting of the car chase would have occurred while Kate was still at Sharon's. The truck driver also gave detectives a partial license plate number for the Camaro, and it didn't match Escobedo's. Wait, get this. One of the cops that also hung out at this chop shop, the rogue cops, his name was Officer Matt Griffin. He had been sentenced to life in prison during this time for multiple bank robberies as well as murder of a witness. He was arrested 1 week before Kate was killed. Although his accomplices were never identified, so they thought maybe there could be a connection there. And then the man whose knife was used, like when Nguyen was using that knife on himself in an attempt on his life, allegedly, he was using a knife that belonged to one of former officer Matt Griffin's friends. Why would you need to borrow a knife for that? That's really weird. And there's just so many of these random connections. And on top of all that, the supervisor of the Albuquerque Police Department was not happy that Lois was questioning the actions of what they described as their impeccable police department. After Lois began to go public with all the information she had, especially about mistakes that she thought police could have made, a bunch of different families of over a dozen New Mexico victims decided to take a good, long, hard look at that impeccable department, as well as other investigative agencies in the Albuquerque area. The message they were sending out was that the citizens of Albuquerque were afraid of their cops. Police in New Mexico have a long and ongoing track record of corruption. In February of 1990, Dennis Martinez was released without charges, and in April of 1991, all of the charges against Miguel Garcia and Juve Escobedo were dropped due to insufficient evidence. After these men were released, Kate's family urged the police to bring Nguyen back in and interview him. They did, and Nguyen was much more open at this time. During this interview, he was honest. He told them about the insurance scam. He told them that at least 10 other Vietnamese men were involved. He also said that he lied about being involved in the insurance scam because a friend told him to. It was this friend that is believed to be the one who made the calls out of Kate's apartment the night that she was pronounced dead. After Nguyen's second interview, his sister and brother-in-law had to come in and get him and drive him back to Kansas City where they lived. And the reason for this is because he needed to be monitored. He was not doing well. Whether anyone thought he was involved in it or not, there was something going on in him, whether it was guilt or just being distraught that someone you loved was killed. Kate's family didn't even know that this sister of Nguyen's even existed. And what Lois wanted everyone to remember and thought was very important for the police was that looking into Nguyen's friends was vital because they were involved with large-scale organized criminal activities in Los Angeles and multi-million dollar insurance frauds. Lois didn't think that the police ever took that seriously, and maybe not. And that's why Lois was compelled to use her own notoriety to get the word out about Kate's death. In 1992, Lois wrote a book entitled Who Killed My Daughter? And this book was basically a brief of everything that happened in her case and the night of the shooting and what happened in the investigation. It was also a plea for any information that people may have related to Kate's murder. With the publication of Lois's book, Kate's case started to garner more attention. It was featured on Good Morning America, Larry King Live, The Sally Jesse Raphael Show, Sightings, and Unsolved Mysteries.
What happened in July of 89?
Kate left our home at about 6:15 saying she was going to her girlfriend's house for dinner. And she also told us she was breaking up with her Vietnamese boyfriend, and if he called trying to find her, not to say where she was, that she would come back to our house to sleep that night. And when she left the girlfriend's house at about 10:45, she was chased down and shot twice in the head within minutes.
Now, did the police thoroughly investigate this?
They did a good job at that point, yes. And then our family began to find out some things that made us think differently.
The family was desperate for tips and answers. I wish this wasn't the reality of the situation, but this case ends up going cold. And year after year, there's still information coming in, but none of it really seemed to be promising. There was one tip. In 1995, a private investigator named Pat Caristo, she was watching Sally Jesse Raphael, and it was featuring Kate's case. She contacted the show and said she had information that she thinks Lois and the police department had missed. Caristo had her own private investigation business, and she was the one that was hired by a lawyer who was working on the insurance claim related to Kate's case. So she was looking into things related to Kate already. And as she was reading police reports from that time, she learned that the young man who had been at Kate's car whenever the police arrived was 21-year-old Paul Apodaca. He had been reported to be driving the gray Volkswagen Beetle. Witnesses also report having seen this vehicle in the area before that. This was the man that said, "I'm just passing through. I was on this well-traveled road, saw what happened, got out, wanted to know if he could help." Police had taken his contact information and then they let him leave. Kate's family said that they had no real idea who pulled the trigger on Kate. But the one thing they felt very strongly about was that she was not shot randomly by people that were just out on a spree, having fun, shooting a pretty girl in a red car. They believed she was killed because she was going to expose the illegal activities involving her boyfriend and his companions. The case still remained cold. There were no bullets and no casings that were ever found, so there was no way to determine if the small caliber bullets that were in Kate's head were the same caliber as the ones that were in the door frame of her car. And if you take a look right here, this is the door frame. The size of the hole in the frame seems to suggest there were maybe two different firearms. It's all too confusing. As Caristo continued to look into the case herself, she came to the conclusion that she believed Kate had not been shot while she was driving and then veered off the road. She believed that Kate had most likely been hit and forced off of the road, which she claims is supported by the damage to the left bumper of her car. And then she thinks that after Kate crashed into the light pole, she put her car in park, and then the shooter approached her and shot at close range through the window. This evidence, of course, is all contrary to the police's version of events. So there was so much debate about what happened. Lois claimed that the Albuquerque Police Department had maintained for years that the suspects that they initially arrested, Miguel Garcia, Dennis Martinez, and Juve Escobedo, were responsible for what happened to Kate, but that they just did not have enough evidence to convict them. And that's why they basically closed the case. An online campaign ran in 1997, and it urged the public all across the United States to email New Mexico officials and convince them that Kate's case needed to be turned over by the Albuquerque Police Department to another agency. And I agree, a second opinion and fresh eyes is always a good choice in a case like this. In 2003, The Bernalillo County Cold Case Squad looked into Kate's case. And at this point, they determined that they also believed Kate had been shot after her car collided with the light pole. They said that due to the accuracy of the shots, it appeared as though they had been fired at close range and not at a moving target. Wow. So why? It seems more and more like it was planned now that she was targeted. Lois would not give up. She insisted that the truck driver go under hypnosis to see if he could recall any more information about the night that he claimed to have spotted Kate's car. And this truck driver agrees. And I know this is like non-conventional way of investigating a crime, but I think you're desperate. During this session, the truck driver said Kate was being chased and that she was chased twice that evening, once on her way to Sharon's and again when she left to go back to her parents' house. He said he saw a girl in a car that resembled Kate being chased and harassed by Hispanic men in a Camaro in the same area of Lomas. But he reported that Kate's Ford Tempo was headed west in the direction of Sharon's house, not east, in the direction that Kate was driving to her parents when she ultimately got killed. The truck driver witnessed this incident over an hour before the shooting. At the same time, police reports say that Kate was driving to Sharon's house. It just still wasn't adding up. Any way they were trying to make it work, it just wasn't. Another thing that I thought was interesting. I'm not against it. I'm not sure how you feel about it. I'm not sure how much weight to give it. And that is psychic investigations. On June 20th, 1994, psychic Robert Petro in Sedona, Arizona, taped a trance reading in reference to Kate's case. How do you feel about this? Because I want to say something. In law school, we did learn about psychics and how police do use them. They aren't the end-all be-all, and who knows how it works, but they are used in criminal investigations and have proven to be accurate in some cases. Like I was saying, I guess families are so desperate, they're going to try anything. Are you wondering what I was wondering? What was said in this trance reading? Because I know I wanted to know. This was all from a website, by the way, that the family owned and operated called realcrimes.com. It was dedicated to families who were trying to find answers and believed their loved ones' cases included police corruption. The motto on this website was real cover-up and corruption by law enforcement, real family frustration and heartbreak. On the section of the site dedicated to Kate's case, there's a disclaimer that says, information from psychics, even the most gifted ones, is seldom totally accurate as it's based upon impressions received by extrasensory perception and is subject to various interpretations. I've used a psychic before. I pretty much do it all in good fun. Sometimes it helps guide me in a way because it helps me think about things. But tell me your thoughts. Now that we know all of that, this is what was reported by psychic Robert Petro during the trance session. This is what he says he saw. Are you ready? I'm going to tell you when this begins and when it ends because I'm going to be talking a lot right here. This is everything he says he's seeing in this trance-like state. He says, I see more than one car. The girl is stopped. Her boyfriend is having a very serious dispute with a trio of other young men. They seem to be arguing over this girl and they reprimand him. They're afraid that he has revealed information to her. One man walks within range of this young girl and shoots her. I don't feel that the car pulled alongside. I feel that everyone was stationary. And then right after the shooting, they left. I feel that the gun was thrown out of a window. I feel that evidence will surface that this group of boys belong to an Asian mafia. This is a close clan, and they will do anything to eliminate exposure. I feel that new evidence will surface because one of the men will be apprehended and will try to make a deal. I feel that the boyfriend is basically a good person, but was hooked up to the wrong people. I feel that his life is now in danger. He will be constantly inconsistent with his information. Right in the heart of Albuquerque, there's some sort of garage or warehouse where they're doing alterations on automobiles. I feel that it also includes local people, meaning Mexicans. I feel that they have altered documentation and paperwork, that it all appears to be forgeries, and I feel that we are dealing with a lot of different players who are very dangerous, but the brains are the Asians. The obstruction of the Albuquerque Police Department in the investigation of this murder only involves a couple people. It does not involve the department in general. I feel by the time the investigation got into the hands of the case investigators, it was already diluted and all of the evidence wasn't given to them. Those who collected the evidence are the ones who hid the evidence. I feel that the Albuquerque Police Department are standing and fighting, and they are right to do that because the evidence was tampered with before it even got to the police department. The Hispanic males who were arrested were used as scapegoats. I somehow see them connected, but then I don't see them connected. But do they know something? The answer is absolutely yes. I feel that someday a person is going to come forward who's just riddled with guilt. He or she can't live with this anymore. That's when you will get your answers. Okay, that was the end of that trance-like state revelation feelings of this psychic. Now, something I didn't say in the last video that got ruined that I want to say here was that, do you notice there's a lot of feelings involved in this? Like, I feel that it's this and I feel that it's that. That makes me feel like this cannot be taken seriously. It has to be taken with a grain of salt. You can't base these things on feelings, but it is some interesting information that I think could have been acquired from news articles that I've read from the same time frame. What was in Kate's mom's book? Like, I don't think you need to be psychic to put some of these things together, but that's just me. Let me know your thoughts. I want to know, have you used a psychic? Do you believe in them? Have you ever experienced a psychic being correct about something? Like I said, interesting information. I will definitely revisit some of these theories later. From 1989 to 2003, there were a number of reports of possible witness intimidation. This to me is very significant, so I wanted to quickly share some of those with you. Okay, on July 21st, the day of Kate's funeral, two injuries happened to people that saw Kate last, Nguyen and Sharon. Sharon had to miss the funeral because she was in the emergency room due to a severe injury to her arm that she said happened because her dog bit her. But it's believed that the scar suggests something else. Now, all this information is found on Lois's website. I just want to make sure you know that. I don't know where it came from, but this is Lois's account of what happened. This was also the same day that Nguyen allegedly attempted to take his own life with the weapon that belonged to someone else. This happened in the room of one of the men who was one of his alibis for the night of the shooting. On August 2nd, 1989, Nguyen's drug dealer apparently ended up with a slashed wrist. They said it was self-inflicted, but get this. That same day, two of the drug dealer's friends who were there when it happened also had their arms and wrists slashed. What? Again, don't know the sources of this information. It was on the family's website dedicated to uncovering the truth about what happened to Kate. But that seems really odd. Why are all these people getting injured? In February of 1990, one of the men that had allegedly been involved in the drive-by when Miguel used the firearm, Dennis Martinez, was found lying in a doorway with his arm slashed too. 2 years later, on February 4th, 1992, shortly after charges were dropped and he was released from prison, Miguel Garcia was shot in the lower portion of his right abdomen and the bullet came out of his back. It was so close to his spine that doctors thought he was going to be paralyzed. He ended up surviving. Allegedly, this was also self-inflicted. The last one mentioned on the site was from September 24th, 2003, when Robert Garcia, the alleged eyewitness to Miguel in the car, who later turned out to be in prison at the time of the shooting, was found dead of a drug overdose. Someone had dragged his body into an alley and left it there. No wonder this case was so hard to solve because there's just so many theories and weird things like this happening. But here's my train of thought. The people we're talking about are criminals. And if you don't know by now, criminals get themselves in interesting, violent, and dangerous situations. So it's not really that uncommon. Now, the wrist situations, I don't even know. But as far as, you know, somebody in an alleyway or some of these other things, it's like, oh, when you play with fire, you're going to get burned. Later in 2013, Lois wrote a sequel to her book, Who Killed My Daughter, and it was entitled One to the Wolves, On the Trail of a Killer. There were basically three major theories at this point. The first one was the Vietnamese connection, which Kate's family strongly believed in, but police had ruled out a long time ago. Lois said at one point that since her family started looking into what happened to Kate, that they had received several death threats and that she believed they were from members of a Vietnamese gang. The second theory was that it was those three men who had been previously arrested, but their conflicting statements and the lack of evidence just made it impossible for them to be charged. And this was the theory that the police stood by the most. The third theory was that that man by the car, Paul Apodaca, he had something to do with it. That police didn't do their due diligence, they dropped the ball, and they didn't question him enough or get enough information from him. And I'd like to know, what did they do when he was on the scene? And what questions did they ask him? Did they search his car? Did they ask him if he had a gun? Did they look if there was any blood on him? Why didn't they do a gunshot residue test on him? Why Nguyen when this guy's on the scene? Did he have a criminal record? I mean, what was the proper procedure and was it followed? At this point in her career, Lois decided she could no longer write horror stories anymore. So she switched to writing children's books, and she said that she couldn't continue writing about young women in life-threatening situations, that it hit way too close to home for her. Kate's family saw four potential motives for Kate's death. We have the theories, now we have the motives. One, Asian crime in New Mexico and California. Two, drug smuggling. Three, New Mexico drug activities, which is kind of the same thing as drug smuggling, but four, police corruption. I don't know why, I guess I do, but I kept thinking, this may really have been random. I said that twice. There are so many crazy people out there on drugs, not even smuggling, not even in crime rings, but straight up off the rails. Lois put so much work and effort in trying to solve her daughter's case. I know I would do the same thing as a mother. And sadly, Lois passed away at the age of 82 on June 15th, 2016. So she never got to see any justice done. And it was very questionable at that time whether justice would ever be done. Lois passed away at her home in Bradenton, Florida, and the cause of death was never disclosed. However, her husband said that she had suffered a series of strokes in the years prior. I guess I just have a really curious mind, but I would like to know how she passed away. Why not disclose it? But most of all, I wanted to know what actually happened to Kate. And you're finally going to find out. This case was on Unsolved Mysteries. They were soliciting tips from all over the country, but nothing came out of it until 32 years later, on July 20th, 2021, almost exactly 32 years after Kate's murder. Yes, 32 years. It's unbelievable. You know all those theories, all the hard work that Lois put in, all the speculation, the private investigators, the alleged police corruption, the psychics? None of that had to do with Kate's death. For the most part. Instead, a serial killer was responsible. He had gotten away with his crimes for three decades. Three decades. Think about that for one moment. That is crazy. Everything came to somewhat of a close when University of New Mexico campus police officers arrested a man who was wandering around the school property, and it turns out they thought he was probably scouting for his next victim. Who, you ask? Paul. Paul who? Paul Apodaca. Do you remember this name? Because it makes me so mad to think that 32 years ago, this man was right in front of police. Worse yet, he was right in front of the crime scene because he created the crime scene. He was Kate's killer all along. No, he didn't stop his car because he was worried about whether Kate was okay. Not at all. Paul, who was 53 at the time of his arrest, had a long history of violence, especially against women. He was arrested in 1995 for forceful intercourse with his 14-year-old stepsister. Paul was homeless when the police officers apprehended him, and he was arrested on a probation violation. It was at this point, while being questioned, that Paul admitted that he had a deep hatred for women. It was during his intake interview that Paul came out with a shocking truth, a secret that he was keeping. So maybe the psychic was right in one way. He said, I feel that someday a person is going to come forward who is riddled with guilt. He or she can't live with this anymore. And that's when you will get your answers. Well, that was true. You'll hear it from Paul himself in a moment, because I have that interview to play. It features Paul confessing to his crimes. The first confession he made was not about Kate. He said that he had committed several murders and had forced himself on several women in the 80s and 90s. Now, the thing is, police hear this all the time. Sometimes criminals, they try to barter to get off on other charges to make a deal. However, the police have a duty to investigate every confession or claim. And it took them several months to look into all the evidence and confirm that Paul had information that only the killer would know. And sadly, that information checked out. First came the indictment for the death of Althea Oakley. I know that this video is about Kate, but if you know me, you would know I can't pass over a victim without giving them the respect and attention that they deserve. Just because Kate's case was more widely publicized because of her mother's career doesn't mean that these other women aren't important. So I briefly want to tell you about Althea and how she died. On June 22nd, 1988, 21-year-old Althea was walking home alone when Paul spotted her. He went after vulnerable women who were easy targets because of the fact that they were alone. He came up behind her and grabbed her, and then came around her and stabbed her 5 times in the chest and the stomach for no other reason but the fact that he could. She wouldn't have been alone that night, but she had gone into an argument with her boyfriend at the frat house on the University of New Mexico campus, and she was going home upset. I would feel so much guilt. I know it's not her boyfriend's fault, but it must haunt him, because I know it would haunt me.
Police say Apodaca told them he wanted to confess to the crimes. What he told officers about the Oakley case matched the crime scene and evidence. She was stabbed to death walking home near TVI, which is now CNM. He said he planned to rape her because he hated women, but he ended up killing her.
After Paul's confession about Althea, a witness actually came forward, and we do have a video. It's a little hard to understand her, but she tried to help her the night of the attack. She wanted to remain anonymous when they interviewed her on TV, but she lived right in front of where this happened. She said that she heard screams, so she ran out to see what happened, and she saw Althea, and there was just so much blood, and it had been so long, but she could remember some things. The one thing she said that she remembered was that Althea did not want to die. And that made me sad. She said that she collapsed right there in front of her house, and at that point she realized there was nothing that she could do, so she just called 911, and they later informed her that Althea didn't make it. I'm going to let you hear what she had to say, but she was just really glad that he was finally caught.
It was a lot of blood, and like I said, it's been so long ago, but I remember she didn't want to die, and she collapsed right there. I'm glad that they found him, and I hope it gives him life, because he didn't deserve that.
Paul told police that he grew up in that neighborhood where he carried out that crime, and they were able to confirm all the details. Next came his second bombshell confession. He was responsible for the shooting death of 13-year-old Stella Gonzalez. She was walking with a friend at 1:15 in the morning on September 9th, 1988. And this was completely random. He just drove up, aimed for the back of her head, shot, and drove away. I will never understand the level of evil, this level of heartlessness, especially as a mother, that life means nothing to that person. I mean, I can't even step on an ant. Then in August of 2021, Paul Apodaca was arrested and charged with Althea Oakley's murder. He was charged with Stella's murder in December of 2021. And finally, just a couple months ago in February 2022, he was indicted for Kate's murder. Police claimed that he included details in his confession that only the killer would know. Here is that interview.
It's taken me so long to know how much pain it caused to this woman that perhaps didn't understand that. After years and years of contemplating and searching, I understand. kind of old pain that occurs, and I feel it for families, for people that I've lived with.
I came here with the understanding that you had information on some homicides, but I did not know that you were talking about yourself. So I'm going to read you your constitutional rights.
I murdered Caitlin Arquette. You know, hopefully. And a girl that was crossing the bridge in Central. But when she died, it seemed like nothing else mattered. And I just kept doing it again because it was like I could not do any more harm.
What did she look like?
I couldn't tell at that range.
How did you kill her?
I shot her at Lomas and Broadway. She continued to drive forward until she lost consciousness and hit the telephone pole.
That's a lot of years to carry that around.
It's a shame that it's taken so much to bring you to this point.
Why did you do it?
I had anger in my heart against women. I resentment.
Why?
Because I've always seen men treat women bad and they have older women, and I tried to be nice and they never appreciated. God is forgiven. I've come to realize that I don't deserve to be forgiven.
Paul is currently awaiting trial. When learning of his confession, Kate's sister Carrie, who is now a criminologist, mostly due to Kate's case, is still critical of Albuquerque Police Department for never questioning Paul and letting him walk away from that crime scene. And Carrie said, "It's only solved because someone stepped forward and confessed. That had nothing to do with the police investigation or lack of over the years." Carrie feels confident that despite the fact Lois is no longer alive to witness Paul finally being convicted and justice found for Caitlin, she feels that Lois's spirit is there and she's looking down. Carrie went on to say that when Paul took Kate from this world, he also took everyone. It caused the family to grow apart, and then after that, the family was broken. These horrific crimes have far-reaching ripple effects into so many people's lives. It is not just the victim dying. It's the future that that victim would have had with all of the people in their life. It's all the people they'll never meet. It's all of the things that their family will never get to see them do. And to think that people can just callously take, just pluck someone from this earth and end it is beyond my understanding. I always try to leave you with a message, something important that I learned from this case. And I guess the one thing that stood out to me was never be alone. I know that's really hard, but they always say like two in, two out. If you go somewhere with your friends, don't leave them behind. I know it's hard. I was just listening to a story the other night. One of my friends said that a friend of hers met a date on Tinder and then like left with him and left her there behind. And maybe you're with other people at a bar, but don't leave your friends behind. Two in, two out. You go with someone, you leave with someone. We can't predict these things. I don't think there's any way Kate could have stopped Paul from doing what he did that night because he was determined to do it. But I guess I'll say what I always do. Please be grateful for everyone in your life. Tell them how much you love them. Cherish every moment because you truly don't know when it's going to be your last. Once again, I want to thank you so much for being here with me every week. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being patient with me being on vacation. I hope this video didn't sound terrible, look terrible. But thank you so very much for watching. I will see you in my next video. Bye.